Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Maine Lett. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Frank Spinner, and together with Major Timothy Thomas, we represent the appellant in this case, Captain Rogelio M. Maine Lett. Let me begin by stating that this is the rare case when mistake of law represents an applicable defense. The court granted on the issue whether or not the military judge erred when he refused to instruct the members on the defense of mistake of law. This case arose in the context of combat operations in Iraq in 2004. Captain Manulet was on a mission where they were establishing an entry control point. They had intelligence that told them that there was a high-value target headed in their direction in a vehicle. They did, at some point, engage the vehicle, and in chasing the vehicle down, subsequently the occupants...
The facts are pretty well established and on that part of the story. Are you relying on the... what are you relying on for the appellant's mistake here?
The mistake, Your Honor, is that Captain Manuel received the law of war briefing, and in that law of war briefing, he received instruction regarding humane treatment and easing suffering.
These are these slides?
Yes, sir.
Which slide in particular would you draw our attention to? I'm not trying to require you to pick one slide, but...
Sir, I will turn your attention to JA 158 and JA 160. And it is a little bit confusing because what at least appears in the appendix, they talk about, I think, and Mr. Korn, the defense's law of war expert, was talking about this. He talked about slide 20. But in JA 158, you have a slide titled Tight and True. There, it references humanity, unnecessary suffering.
Which is one of the general principles of the law of armed conflict, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and from that bullet, the appellant decides that euthanasia is the what the law of armed conflict permits? I'm asking.
Well, also, may I also reference JA 160, which says why comply, and at the bottom it says the right thing to do. And I wanted to be complete in answering the first question, Your Honor.
What about JA 164, where it says soldiers do not kill or torture enemy prisoners of war? It basically talks about not killing the enemy if they're not engaged in battle.
Judge Ryan, and I may have respond to Judge Baker's question first.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's part and parcel of the same question.
Well, and I'm pleased to answer both. And there was great discussion on this point by the law of war expert regarding the fact that in terms of humane treatment and relieving suffering, this is what Captain Manulet took from the briefing.
You have answered my question, though. I wanted to make sure I understood which slides were the critical slides in your argument as to what he was relying on.
Right.
Okay.
Right. The clearly, what he was engaged in was not any sort of torture. And I think, Your Honor, you have to look at it in the context of the case.
What about 165, soldiers collect and care for the wounded, whether friend or foe? I guess my question is it your view that a mistake of law defense is available whenever an appellant decides to pick and choose from particular parts of a presentation?
No, Your Honor, and I don't think there's any indication, there's no contradiction between what was presented in the slides you identified in these other slides and his understanding of what the slides meant. In fact, when you look at the facts of the case, he asked his medic to go treat anyone who was in the vehicle who was injured, and then when he received word from his medic that the individual was beyond help, then Captain Manuel sent his medic into the house where they thought other people, other insurgents were located, to see if there was anyone who needed care there. So he was in full compliance with these slides as he understood the principles to be. He was having his
medical... Back to me, how about the ROE card?
Well, the ROE...
You're supposed to operate off of slides or ROE cards when Lance Corporal Smith goes out?
Well, ROE cards are just brief statements, as I think reminders for soldiers to know how to conduct themselves. I don't see any conflict between the ROEs.
What about 1B? Do not engage anyone who has surrendered or is out of battle due to sickness or wounds.
Right, Your Honor. Captain Manulet explained himself, I think, very clearly, and Mr. Korn, who worked with the defense and looked at these facts, who is an expert in the law of war, saw no contradiction between the rules that governed here and what Captain Manulet believed that his duties were under the circumstances. And I think if you
could that paragraph have been, is that poorly written? Is that not clear on the ROE cards?
In this instance, the situation the captain, well, it's, everything is clear up to a point until you have a body with the brains, where the brain's been shot out or whatever, where your medic tells you the guy is going to be dead in minutes. Everything is clear until you have a factual situation. That's why the law of war briefing included at the end of it multiple scenarios to show soldiers who received the briefing how these rules applied in the context of combat operations. The one unfortunate aspect of this was that he did not receive the scenario that explained, okay, Captain, here's what you do when you have someone who is on the verge of death, who appears to be suffering immensely, and your medic has told you that he will not survive. There's no sense rendering him any medical care at that point. I mean, I think it's fair to refer that if medical care would have made a difference at this point, Your Honor, I think that the medic would have stayed with the individual. In fact, Captain Manulet said that he had, in fact, himself treated Iraqis on other occasions where he saw that they needed medical care. Clearly, Captain Manulet understood that he had a duty to provide care and treatment for wounded enemy combatants who were outside of the conflict at that point.
Okay, you're relying exclusively on mistake of law here. You're not taking the position that defense counsel originally took, which was that this was authorized by the law of war. In the 39A session, he made that statement, and then he went and talked to, and then he came back and said, no, I don't mean that.
Right. He said...
You're relying on mistake of law.
That is correct.
Okay.
You're relying on mistake of law.
And you're relying on the reliance on the decision or pronouncement of an authorized public official language in the discussion of 916?
Right.
Okay.
Right, and that's why we took some time in our brief addressing Commonwealth versus Twitchell, because when you look at the federal cases in this area, there were really none with a comparable factual scenario or legal situation in terms of the crimes involved. When you look at Commonwealth versus Twitchell, however, that is a context of a mercy killing case based on religious principles, and the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts addressed a number of these things, which I think are comparable to this case. For instance, in Twitchell, the court addressed the fact that the appellant in that case was relying on an attorney general opinion. However, they had never seen the attorney general opinion. It was what had been reproduced in a pamphlet provided by their religious community.
Isn't there a substantial difference between a state AG opinion on a matter of state law and a passing, glancing reference in a slide?
No, I don't think there is. First of all, and that's why I'm making this point, Your Honor, is that they weren't really relying. In fact, I don't even know that there was any evidence that they relied on the Attorney General opinion or understood that it came from the Attorney General. What they were relying on was a pamphlet provided by a religious organization which stated the Attorney General opinion. Furthermore, that Attorney General opinion did not really address manslaughter to the extent that it was cited.
Counsel, I have a couple of questions for you. This language in 916L1, do you think that's the codification of the, for instance, the Supreme Court case in Raleigh and the entrapment by estoppel in the circuit courts, or is it something different? And I ask that to find out whether or not you think we can go to those cases to help us interpret that language.
Well, what I would say is, is that the primary source should be the Supreme Court decisions in Raley versus Ohio and Cox v. Louisiana, because basically they're applying the due process clause. So in that sense, I would say that your beginning point would be the Supreme Court decisions on due process.
That would be separate then from 916 in your view.
Well, first of all, 916, it's a discussion, and so I don't know what weight to give that as a matter of law. I would certainly look at that, but I would also look at what the Supreme Court has said in Raley versus Ohio and Cox v. Louisiana.
Well, when we look at that, when we look at the language of 916, and we look at Raley, and we look at Benning, they all reference some type of pronouncement. And here there was no pronouncement. I think the facts are pretty clear. It was his misunderstanding or how he interpreted what the briefing said as applied to this fact. And he actually said that this scenario wasn't discussed. So where do we get then from misunderstanding to a pronouncement by a government official?
Again, Your Honor, that's why I put great weight on Massachusetts Supreme Court decision, because they cite Raley versus Ohio, and that's why I make the argument. I think the best beginning is not some discussion note under 916. I think the best place to start is Raley versus Ohio, and that's where the Massachusetts Supreme Court started. They relied on Raley versus Ohio, and so and if the Massachusetts Supreme Court could then say that the appellants in that case relied on a publication which only restated the Attorney General's opinion, then in this case there's no reason why...
Isn't this a quintessential military law case? I mean, this is not a question of whether they were following... Oh, by the way, you said you had a couple questions. Did you get them both out?
Yeah, I did. This
is not a case of in the rear... what the medical hospital is supposed to do or not do, or something like this. This is four square, a military orders or pronouncements case. So shouldn't we look to military law rather than civilian law to decide what's at stake here?
Manslaughter is manslaughter. I don't think manslaughter in the military is different from manslaughter.
So we should apply Massachusetts law rather than the manual.
Massachusetts law was applying Supreme Court law in Raley versus Ohio.
And the heck with the manual.
Well, I'm not saying the heck with the manual. If Your Honor, obviously, as the judge, you can go with the manual, or you can go with Raley versus Ohio. For me, I'm just asking for relief from my client.
No, I understand that, but don't you? I'm trying to guide you back to the manual, because I think in a case that's squarely a military law case, unlike some, we do a lot of cases that are criminal law, that you couldn't mistake this case from something else in a state court. This is not the average case in a state court.
Here's the problem as I see it, Your Honor, based on military appellate courts that have addressed mistake of law as a defense, of which there are very few. It is, I think, clearly recognized that it's a very rare situation, whether you're talking about military or civilian law, that it would ever apply. And so that's why I began this argument saying this is one of those rare cases where the instruction should have been given on mistake of law.
If we hold that instruction should have been given here, isn't this going to open the floodgates? This won't be a rare case, because everybody that ever heard something is going to claim mistake of law.
Your Honor, I can't deal with floodgates. I mean, that's a problem for the court. That's not my problem. What I have to deal with is the case that I have here before the court.
Well, even if you rely on the Raley case in the Supreme Court, in that case they were talking about an active misleading. Don't you think there's a difference between active misleading and someone's misapprehension of language that is fairly clear?
I would say that's a question of fact for the members to resolve whether there was an active mislead. And even Twitchell addresses this as well. It talks about...
Well, even the counsel at trial didn't suggest that there was an active misleading. He suggested that it could have been more complete. There was never a suggestion that anyone from the United States government informed anyone that euthanasia was appropriate.
And that's why I keep coming back to Twitchell, Your Honor. Twitchell dealt with Raley as well. That was not a problem for the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And I'm saying that this court should follow the reasoning and logic of Twitchell in addressing that very point.
And the language that you're relying on from the presentation that was given is the humanity language?
Yes, Sean, but also the testimony of my client and the testimony of Mr. Korn.
And with respect to humanity, you're talking about the fact that it was a humane thing to do to kill someone to put them out of their misery?
From a mercy killing standpoint, yes, Sean.
Okay, are you suggesting then that enemy combatants are entitled to greater humanity than civilians? So, for example, if someone found me in a similar situation in the streets of Washington, D.C., wouldn't humanity require the same result?
One of the examples, Your Honor, that was discussed had to do, for instance, if you're on the streets of D.C. and there's a passenger in a burning vehicle and there's no way to rescue them, what is the humane thing to do? Would you be permitted to shoot them to relieve them, especially if they ask you to shoot them to relieve them from their pain and suffering when rescue is impossible? That's a very difficult question to say how far you go in a particular situation. So. I can't say that there's not a situation that would arise where someone would be very challenged to decide what to do.
At your peril. A decision they would make at their own peril.
At their own peril, that's correct.
So the law of armed conflict applies in the streets of D.C.?
No, I'm just responding to a question. In this case, where the reliance is upon the laws of armed conflict.
Is there anything in the record indicating that...
Your Honor, my time has expired. I don't know.
You're going to have some more time because I think there'll be a few more questions.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything in the record indicating that any of the enlisted personnel who were serving with the appellant were confused on this issue? Did they testify as to their own confusion? This is a flat question, not a trick question.
Right. I don't recall anyone testifying on that, Your Honor, but... my focus in preparation was on the joint appendix, and so I don't recall.
Okay, fair enough. Is there anything in the record indicating whether the captain radioed for guidance?
Yes.
Did he or did he not?
He did not radio for guidance. Okay. And he said there was a lot of traffic, and because of the operation activity that was going on, that was why he didn't.
Does the record reflect that he was unable to radio for guidance?
No, it does not reflect that he was unable. He testified to that point, Your Honor.
Thank you.
When we're dealing with a request for a mistake of law instruction, do we start with the assumption that there is indeed a mistake of law, that is, the accused view of the law was incorrect? And that is, for purposes of this case, do we start with the assumption that the authority to shoot the victim in this case was not there, and that was the mistake of law that the accused held? Because it's not a defense of justification. It's not a defense of obedience of order. So if it's a defense of mistake of law, do we start with the assumption that the accused had an incorrect view of the law?
Yes, sir.
And then what then moves us from that assumption to the instruction by the military judge? That is, what standard does the judge apply in deciding whether or not to give that instruction? Because mistakes of law happen all the time, and the normal view of the law is that people are presumed to understand the law and required to obey it. So here we're going to get out of that. Now, what is the standard that moves us from the idea that the person had an incorrect view of the law, but they're nonetheless entitled to an instruction? How does the judge go about making that decision?
Mr. Korn, I think, addressed that, Your Honor, when he talked about the fact that the slides and the briefing did not clearly explain what relieving suffering meant and humane treatment. And so Captain Manuelet relied on just what he saw as the meaning of that language in the factual context that he found himself in.
Does this understanding have to be reasonable? What standard does the judge apply?
Based on the cases, I would say yes, it has to be reasonable. It has to be honest and reasonable.
Honest and reasonable. Now, if in this scenario that we had here, a superior officer came and instructed the defendant to shoot in this situation, would he have a defense of obedience to a lawful order at that point if he went ahead and shot?
If this court gave him one.
But wouldn't it be an unlawful order at that point? That is, we're assuming that it's unlawful here and there's been no proof that it's lawful.
The problem is that it would not be clear in that hypothetical what the commander's understanding of the law was. And was the commander giving him an order?
Isn't the defense under 916 that a person of ordinary sense and understanding would have known the orders to be unlawful under 916?
That would be.
So should we apply a similar standard here? That is, would a person of ordinary sense and understanding have understood the order?
See, I think that's where...
Or the briefing.
The point we're at, though, is, has the issue been raised? And so that would be a question of fact, a question for the jury to resolve whether or not that is the case.
So he gets the instruction in any case?
No, and yes, you have to show that there's a reason. You have to show that first. You have to show each of the requirements, as I understand it, for this defense. So you would have to show that there was some pronouncement by some authority, which we say came through the briefing. You have to show that there was a reasonable reliance upon that authority for the act that was committed, and then ultimately, then you have to look at was this a reasonable reliance. And that's where you get to the last criteria. So you have to have all of those before you get the instruction.
How does this play into the doctrines we have regarding who makes the decision as to what the state of the law is, the judge or the court-martial panel? Doesn't the judge have to make an initial determination as to the state of the law?
The judge has to make that determination. Yeah.
That's all questions I have. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
I just have one question, which is, you can think about it more while you're waiting for your opportunity on rebuttal, is basically, do you have any question that the military judge in this case did everything he could to explore the state of the law and seek to see if there was a legal basis for this instruction?
Do I think he did everything he could?
That he looked into it, that he asked the defense counsel for it, that he looked for cases, that he asked for some steps, for some guidance, whether it be case law or otherwise.
I can answer that now, Your Honor. He apparently just looked at military law. He did not look at federal or state decisions construing Brady versus Ohio. That's my recall of the record.
On rebuttal, answer as well whether he precluded anybody, any testimony that might have fleshed this out as well.
I'm sorry,
did he preclude anybody from testifying in a manner that would have, in your judgment, prevented this from being developed?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. Captain James Daniel Long, Colonel Norman Allen for the government. This is not an extraordinary circumstance. This is not the type of case that implicates the mistake of law defense. In this case, the evidence shows that Captain Manuelet had specific notice about how to respond when confronted with a wounded enemy who was out of combat. He had the benefit of the slides on the rule of engagement card, which said, do not engage anyone out of battle due to sickness or wounds. That's at Joint Appendix 168. He also had the soldier rules, These appear at Joint Appendix 164 and 5. Soldiers collect and care for the wounded, whether friend or foe. Soldiers do not kill or torture enemy prisoners of war. Soldiers do not harm enemies who surrender, disarm them, and turn them over to your superior. There was also the benefit of the slide on military necessity. This appears at Joint Appendix 162. That which is not forbidden by law and indispensable for submission of the enemy. Here we have an Iraqi who is already unconscious. No need to submit. We also have the slide.
Are you suggesting that there are contexts where military necessity would permit the killing of wounded enemy combatants?
Not in a case like this, Your Honor.
Not in a case like this, but in some cases it's the government's view that it's appropriate to kill wounded combatants, non-combatants?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. The only thing that I'm saying is that unless there is a necessity, there has to be a necessity to act before you act. And in this case, there was no necessity to subdue.
And if there is necessity, therefore, what? The rules of engagement involving the treatment of non-combatants or people who are out of combat pertain, or that's the end of the analysis?
I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's question. The standard here would not be...
Is military necessity the sole standard, or is there more to the analysis as to how you treat wounded combatants? That's my question. And I'm only playing off of what you say.
Sure. The issue here, though, is whether or not this mistake of law defense is in play. And there is a question about the availability of the defense, which is distinguishable from whether or not that the defense can be applied. The availability of the defense has two essential elements. These are part of an interlocutory question of law that the military judge decides. First, there has to be a statement from a misstatement of the law from an authorized public official, but two, and this is the key in this case, the statement has to contain an affirmative assurance that the particular conduct giving rise to the conviction was lawful. And we don't have such a specific, actively misleading statement here. Essentially, there is no evidence of a positive assurance that a killing that's motivated by the desire to ease suffering would be lawful.
Are the same slides still being used today?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you the same hypothetical that I asked the defense. That is, if he had received an order to take the action, if the defendant had received an order to take the action that he took here, and if all the evidence that was placed in this case would have been placed in that case, that is, attempting to show the defense on the grounds of the ambiguity and his interpretation of all the briefings he had received, would he be entitled to an instruction on the defense of obedience to orders under 916D?
No, Your Honor.
Why is that? Why, if having received this briefing and the information received, would a person of ordinary sense and understanding not have known whether the orders were lawful or not?
Well, I think the issue that's at stake in the unlawful orders defense has to do with knowledge of an order and also whether it's reasonable or not. There's a different standard. There's a different set of elements that are involved in the entrapment by estoppel theory of mistake of law. The principle at issue in mistake of law is one of fair notice of the law, and that's why Raleigh versus Ohio, Cox versus Louisiana, and all of the subsequent cases in federal and even state courts that rely on those cases require an actively misleading statement, because the focus is not some, you don't, the beginning premise is not whether the accused is confused as to what the law was. The start of the analysis begins with, is there a statement from the government that disrupts what notice of the law is.
So would that, to take my hypothetical and change it slightly, would that be the case if he had made the phone call and described the situation and was advised by headquarters that it was permissible to shoot the victim in this case? Would that then raise the mistake of law defense?
That would be a much closer case, and it very well may. Again, you'd still have to establish the official status of the person, but if you had an actively misleading statement that was erroneous as to what the law required, and then it was also specific as to the conduct. The Rowley case is a good example of this. In Rowley, you had a statement by a legislator who was conducting investigative hearings telling the defendants that they could rely on a privilege against self-incrimination and not provide testimony. The state then prosecuted them for not providing that testimony. That is the type of specific, actively misleading statement that the Supreme Court was concerned about when they're talking about the principle of fair notice of the law. We don't have that here. In fact, we have a stipulation at Joint Appendix 140 that says that the Mercy killing scenario was not covered. Well, if it was not covered, then that is a concession in the stipulation that there was no statement that you could deliberately kill a wounded enemy combatant if you were motivated by a desire to ease suffering.
Counsel, in your view, were you done with your sentence?
Yes, sir.
In your view, in the government's view, not your view, in the government's view, should this court look to civilian law in part or in whole or not at all in addressing the question before the court?
Your Honor, I believe that the court would look to other law, and the reason is because if you start with the statutory construction, all it says in RCM 916L1 is that ordinarily mistake of law, ignorance or mistake of law, will not be a defense. That word ordinarily may open the door to, well, what is the extraordinary case? And the extraordinary case is not, the elements of the potential defense are not further defined. We have the discussion, and the discussion does state that mistake of law may be a defense when it results from a decision or pronouncement of an authorized government official. But absent that, we would look to legislative history, which there's nothing further in the manual that discusses why the discussion includes this. It appears to be a reflection of what the state of the case law is.
So you think your position is that the language in 916 is a codification of entrapment by estoppel of that theory in the.
Well, the discussion is not a codification, but it does reflect what the state of the law is to provide further advice to those who are looking at the manual on how to interpret. So the manual discussion sections do reflect what the state of the law happens to be.
State of the law meaning civilian law is what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
I think we're both trying to get you to say yes or no. We should look to the Massachusetts Supreme Court or not, for example, in deciding this question involving the law of armed conflict.
Again, I would say yes in this case because there is an absence of military law directly on point.
And then if we are applying civilian law in part or in whole, we would be looking to the concept of entrapment by estoppel, which is to repeat Judge Erdman's question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, we should, or
well,
question loud and clear.
Well, it's the court would have to make a threshold determination that the statutory language opens the door to the entrapment by estoppel defense at all. But a fair reading of the word ordinarily implies that it may be a defense in some circumstances. We are just left without military jurisprudence, and we're left without further statutory guidance as to what the elements are. So what else could be the source of determining what the elements of the defense are.
Well, didn't the concept of entrapment by estoppel stem from the Rainey case?
Which case, Your Honor? The Raleigh case?
Raleigh, however you pronounce
it. Yes, Your Honor. Raleigh was the one that I briefly summarized. And the Raleigh case does have this specificity requirement for the actively misleading statement. Quoting from Raleigh, it says, here we have more than commands that are simply vague or even contradictory. There was active misleading. And that's at page 1266. If Raleigh sets the standard, then the standard must include such an affirmative statement as to what the law was. Again, a misstatement of the law. And the slides pointed to by the defense, the tried and true slide and the why comply slide, these are at most vague statements. Humanity, unnecessary suffering, do the right thing. We have all of these other counter directions from the law of war briefing that say do not engage the wounded, collect and care for the wounded. Those instructions were not done. And to the extent that the defense is raising an argument as a matter of equity, as was pointed out by the defense expert, laches would seem to apply as well in that case, that if Captain Manuelette found himself trying to rely on these vague concepts, what about the specific concepts? Do not engage the enemy wounded and out of battle, collect and care. Those things were not done.
In terms of the defense of entrapment by estoppel, the government has, as I read the brief, you have not asked us to expressly reject that doctrine, have you?
No, Your Honor.
And does the government want us to do that? Does the government want us to rule that a soldier who contacts an authoritative superior and receives guidance that a particular act is permissible would be precluded from invoking the doctrine of estoppel at that point, entrapment by estoppel? Do you want us to say that a soldier can't do that?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And just to follow up on that, there is an entrapment defense. It seems like the substantive difference between the entrapment defense in 916 and this entrapment by estoppel doctrine would be a focus on the government's intent. The entrapment defense, you would have to determine that the government was actively trying to induce or trick the defendant into committing the conduct. The entrapment by estoppel defense doesn't require the trickery aspect of that. There could just be a misstatement of the law by, again, an authorized public official. That is the availability of the defense. There's another step in the analysis, though, and that is the application of the mistake of law defense. And only if the defense is legally available as a threshold matter do we apply the defense and allow a panel to determine whether or not this was a reasonable reliance or not. So to the extent that there is an analysis about was the soldier feigning mistake of law or not, that goes into the application of the defense. But the availability of the defense is a question of law. And the threshold elements have to be satisfied before you get to an application of the defense.
Is there anything in the record indicating that folks were briefed on the relationship between ROE and anything that had been stated to them prior about the law of armed conflict?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing reflected about the training other than the two sources of what was contained in the training are the stipulation of fact that appears at Joint Appendix 140, and then the training slides themselves. That's what we have in the record about what the training was. What Mr. Korn, in his expert witness testimony, did was he seemed to isolate on the two slides that contain the general principles about humanity and doing the right thing without taking into consideration their broader context as to all the other instructions that were explained during the law of war briefing. And as pointed out before, it includes statements What do you do when you confront an enemy wounded combatant who's out of the battle? You don't engage them. You provide care. You do not harm them. You have to have positive identification. And to the extent that a soldier is confused or does not know what the law requires, they should be asking a question. They should consult their next highest command. And in this case, the record does reflect that Captain Manuelet did have an opportunity to radio in friendly fire. During that same opportunity, he did not ask his next higher command, would killing this Iraqi be okay, be authorized?
What amount of specificity is required for affirmative misrepresentation?
Since the principle relates to fair notice of the law, it has to be particular as to what the law prescribed. So in this case, he was punished for deliberate killing, and there would have to be authority saying the killing is authorized under the law. In conclusion, should the court use this case as a vehicle for recognizing the existence of the mistake of law defense, the court should breathe life into the statutory text and require extraordinary circumstances. This is not an extraordinary case. Captain Manuelet's deliberate killing of a wounded Iraqi out of battle was motivated by his own interpretation of the law, not the product of an official statement that was actively misleading as to what the law required. Due process concerns are not implicated and the defense has failed. Accordingly, this court should find that there is no instructional error and affirm the findings of the sentence below.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
I would like to begin by noting Joint Appendix page 122, which is page 682 in the record. Judge Pohl says, I can find no authority that would permit the mistake of law defense to apply in this case based on what I have. And then he says, in the cases that I've cited, talked to you about Rockwood, Hewitt, Vaughn, Kelly, and another CMR case, Duffy, all of them none directly on point, seem to say that a mistake of law is not a defense. Obviously, there was some considerable dialogue between the counsel and the judge on these issues, but there was no reference to the cases, any of the cases that we've cited in our brief. Furthermore, Judge Baker, I think you had asked, did the judge preclude any evidence? I think the defense was able to put before the judge all the evidence that they wanted to on the issue. Of course, that evidence did not go to the members.
Right. No, I understand that. That was a thank you. That does address my question, which is, did you have the shot with the judge?
The other point I want to make here, the government seems to be taking the position that there was a duty to provide care, and the soldiers failed to comply with that duty. In fact, I want to bring the court back to what I think is an important point. Captain Manuelet did have his medic attempt to provide care, and the information that he received was that care would have no value in this instance, that the individual was dying, would die shortly, and so it was a foregone conclusion. And so this isn't a case where in a combat operation, an enemy is captured who requires medical treatment and care, and the officer in charge just decides to, quote unquote, execute him. That's not the factual scenario here. Captain Manuelet was faced with a situation where he's basically told by his expert, this individual is beyond care or treatment. And so now Captain Manuelet said, what do? I see this guy suffering. This appears to be suffering that was bothersome to him, and it seemed to be an inhumane thing to just let him lie there and suffer as he was suffering. And of course, it was an issue in trial as to whether or not he was already brain dead, and apparently the determination was that the government could not prove that he was alive beyond a reasonable doubt.
Does the record reflect whether they provided any palliative care morphine, anything of that sort?
I don't think that, it's my understanding from the record that there was no care provided whatsoever, morphine or otherwise. But I think also the concern was there was only one medic and that there were other individuals, and so it was a matter of addressing the needs where care could be provided and actually help someone. So it became a matter of using the resources that way. Furthermore, I want to go back to the Twitchell case, because in Twitchell, the Massachusetts Supreme Court dealt with the issues related to Wheeler versus Ohio and whether or not there was any sort of active misleading or whether or not the pronouncements that were relied on by the accused were vague. And in any event, where the Massachusetts Supreme Court ended up was that even though the Twitchells relied on this publication, religious publication, it was not vague to the point that they felt that would take the defense away. And so I would just close by saying that we believe that as you look at how the Massachusetts Supreme Court construed and applied Raley, that should give guidance to this court by analogy on how to apply Raley in this case. And we would ask you to do that.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.